Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
And welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, China claims that it has eradicated poverty. We look at the different metrics the Chinese use to measure economic well-being. Zippe is here, and we look at the evolving Revolut wars. Plus, why do we need 6G when most of us are managing just fine with 5G? Aren't we? You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, my explainer this week is in response to a listener's query. We got this email in recently. Love your show and you've ignited an interest in economics in me. I was thinking about maybe sitting the Leaving Cert economics paper and wasn't sure about how to go about this. Maybe you could do a slot on your show on how somebody might pursue their interest and what courses you'd recommend and how we'd go about it. I think I'd be fine studying it alone, but maybe there's people, as well as yourself, that you'd recommend on following on YouTube or whatever. So first of all, thanks so much for your message, Adrienne, and here's my suggestions. I've three for you. One is you can go to findacourse.ie and search for economics in there. Now, I ran a search myself before coming on air, and there's lots available. The second thing is, of course, yes, you can sit the Leaving Cert, but if you simply want to study it, you could get one of the textbooks. I wrote one myself with Stephen Moylan called Economics in Our World. So you could then download the Leaving Cert papers and solutions from examinations.ie and test out your knowledge from there. And alternatively, you can always ask ChatGPT to essentially be your economics coach either. But Adrienne, because of your very kind message, I'm going to ask our team here at News Talk to reach out to you and we'll post out a signed copy of Economics in Our World to you as a thank you for being a loyal listener and sending us in such a lovely message. Now, since entering the Irish market in 2022, Revolut has become the easiest way to transfer money, but it has also taken on more and more features of a traditional bank. This week saw the three pillar banks in Ireland, AIB, Bank of Ireland and PTSB, join forces and launch Zippe, an app within their existing banking apps. And this promises customers of each bank the opportunity to pay and transfer cash, just like Revolut. So Donal McNamee, journalist with the Business Post, joins me now. Donal, this seems to be the way in which the three pillar banks are seeking to catch up with simply the ability to transfer money between customers in as easy a way as Revolut is. Is that it? Is that all that it does? Sorry to sound underwhelmed.
For now, that is all it does. This is kind of a sign that for the banks that they're sort of in the game belatedly in what's known as peer-to-peer payments, something that Revolut has sort of cannibalized in the last 10 years or so. For the banks, it's a milestone, I suppose. It shows that like they are capable of getting out a product that will allow customers to instantly transfer money. I think there's plans, and there definitely was. This is not the first time the banks have tried to launch a product like this. They tried something like this before and it was abandoned due to regulatory issues. And that project, which is rhymes with the current one, Zippe, was called Yippe. That was to be able to facilitate e-commerce and point of sale and like do a little bit more than just P2P, me to you transfers. This is kind of, at least at the initially, this is just P2P. This is like basically doing what Revolut, I guess, has been offering for around a decade in Ireland. So you're not wrong. And I think it's probably not unfair to sound a little bit underwhelmed either.
Well, the reason I'm saying that is when you look at the Revolut offering now, there is the interest-bearing accounts, there's the vaults, we'll say there's the Rev points, they've branched now into, say, offers and so on with different companies. So I can't imagine the three pillar banks following that process of, you know, maybe points or giving you X amount of points if you book a hotel stay through AIB. I just couldn't imagine that. So how is it seeking to really compete then, or is it?
I think the sort of crux of the bank's argument here would be when you go onto your Revolut, either you're one of the few people, fewer than 5% of Revolut's customers, who get their salary paid in and use it as your primary account, or else you're like the majority of people who, when you want to use your Revolut, you have to top it up every now and again. Now, I don't know how much of a friction point that is for people. I think people are pretty used to Revolut and like how it operates. I suppose like if you're a PTSB customer now, you don't have to go topping up your account if you want to send money. You know, you can use your your AIB, your Bank of Ireland, or your PTSB account, at least in theory, in the same way you can use a Revolut without having to go into to be flipping between apps. I don't know how much of a pain point that is for people. That is an argument that I've heard the BPFI, the Banking and Payments Federation of Ireland, making this week. And I don't think it's unreasonable. I just don't know how much of an advantage it is that you don't have to do the extra step that you have to do on Revolut. And therefore, the jury's out, I guess, in terms of how much people will warm to it and how much adoption there will be of Zippay.
Well, when you say people will warm to it, in the statement, Zippay said it will begin rolling out on a phased basis with potential to reach more than 5 million eligible customer accounts of the three retail banks. You know, we talk about the ability, the peer-to-peer payments. We talk about that being a small thing, but yet that was the tail that wagged the dog with Revolut, really, wasn't it? Certainly, that was the reason I set up my account there anyway, is simply to have that ability. All the other stuff then came afterwards. So perhaps this also could stem the flow of people if they simply want peer-to-peer payments, that they would stay with their traditional provider. And therefore, it's not just about we're competing against this, so people will come to us for this, but more so people wouldn't leave us for that factor.
Yeah, that's definitely like a big part of, I would say, the bank's thinking here. Like, you know, instant payments, P2P payments, they don't generate any revenues for the banks or for Revolut. Like, they're a way of facilitating your customers such that they don't keep their money elsewhere, you know, and you know, the Revolut has cannibalized the payments market, but it hasn't got huge quantities of customer deposits. Like, the banks have made so much money based on this cheap deposit-based funding that they have. Like, they've you know, 150 billion roughly in retail deposits between the three of them. So, like, in a sense, they sort of, like, that war, they didn't end up losing it as much as maybe had been feared. However, it was optically really bad that, like, the three pillar banks in the country, which are all generating billions in profits, didn't have functionality that could compete with a fintech or what you could get kind of broadly around the continent. Like, one of the main reasons, I think we all know, that Revolut has been so successful in Ireland and counts Ireland as one of its sort of most successful markets by way of market penetration is there was no competition for them when they came in. Like, the banks just weren't at the races at all. It's taken them a long time to get there. Whether it's enough, whether it's meaningful either way, kind of remains to be seen.
And yet, you know, the banks had to do something like this. I mean, that's the point, I would imagine. Can I also ask you as well, am I right in that I heard you there when you said 5% of people get their salary paid into Revolut in Ireland? Is that right?
Yeah, it's under 5%. That's what Revolut said at an Oireachtas committee about 3 weeks ago. So that was really interesting to hear them say that.
And Donal, as I sit here in front of you in March 2026, that might be the case. But if we were to roll on in the years, I would, and nothing else changed, of course, which is highly unlikely, but I would imagine that younger people, the next generation, like, their go-to financial transaction app would likely be Revolut. Do you see that percentage growing as, we'll say, today's teenager becomes tomorrow's graduate, and when they're earning their own salary, that they might default to that? Maybe that's the long-term game that Revolut are playing.
That's Revolut's bet for sure. Like, that's what they always talk about in an Irish context, is like the Revolut Junior. Like, you know, every parent in the country has their, or a lot of them anyway, you know, have their children set up on Revolut Junior. And as you say, they, at some point, those Revolut Junior accounts become adult Revolut accounts. And maybe at that point, it's so, you know, the system is set up such that these people are getting their, start to get their salaries paid into the Revolut. And then in the long term, maybe Revolut wins. The problem for Revolut has been trust. Has been that, like,
you can't ring Revolut and complain.
They would probably dispute that a little bit, but like the quantum and sort of tone of the headlines, and like, what, it's not just media headlines. Like, anyone you talk to, if you talk to 10 people, a lot of them will have had a problem with Revolut when it comes to customer care. Revolut have invested heavily in that. There's a sense that, and this is probably more like empirical than like, you know, based on quantitative data, but like, the Revolut, are, given that they're so tech focused, that maybe the human touch is sometimes lacking. And then if you've got a problem, it's very hard to get it sorted out. And like, Revolut were sort of publicly dressed down by Piers Doherty, the Sinn Féin finance spokesman at an Oireachtas committee, which was pretty damaging. Like, that speaks to the sort of the problem that they have with trust, and that's what they need to overcome if they want to become a player that has, you know, most people using it, or even a substantial chunk of people using it as their primary account, which they don't have at the minute.
If we look at Zippay and its plans, I want to look backwards and look forwards. As you say, Yippay didn't survive due to regulation as distinct to anything else. But when we look forward, Zippay, on the other hand, first of all, I noticed that that is going to be, because it hasn't come up in my, I do have an account with one of the traditional banks, and it hasn't appeared yet in mine, because I was testing it out last night just to make sure that, to see what it was like, and it wasn't there. So I don't know what the user experience would be like, but it's an app within an app. It's not something where I have to create a username and password, I understand yet. So I would imagine the UX, probably the user experience, is right. The question is, will it succeed? And part of its rollout plans is also to extend into OnPost and the credit unions, where one could draw on those two and have the same sort of transactions. So based on what we've seen before with Yippay, what do you see the future of Zippay being? You know, and I know I'm asking you to look into a crystal ball, but sure, I can do that.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I'll do my best. The banks are very clear, like, they want this to be open, they want this to be available to everyone. That's the credit unions, that's OnPost, that's also like Revolut, if they want. Revolut have suggested that they don't have any interest in joining. I think optically, if Revolut joined, it would suggest that they, you know, feel that they need to, and I suppose they feel like, we already have everyone, why would we optically join this, what they would probably describe as a legacy bank project. It's really hard to know. I do think, like, there will be some engagement between the BPFI and Nexi, who's the Italian firm that developed Zippay and also was building Yippay as well, and other sort of fintechs and neobanks, you know, the likes of Monzo might have a conversation with them, I'm sure, the likes of Bunk, the likes of N26, like Revolut are in a sort of a privileged position, which they've earned, of having 3.2 million customers. They don't really need to converse with, if they don't want to, whereas there's others that might have more reason to talk.
Well, Revolut has also, of course, been busy, because just this week we see that Revolut has secured a full banking license from UK regulators now. 4 years they've been waiting for this, and they have 13 million UK customers. But now, at the moment, the banking division could only hold £50,000 in total deposits. Is this time for Revolut really to shine? Because they've also said they want to crack the US market. So where do you see the future of the Revolut business in total, apart from peer-to-peer payments, going?
Well, this is the thing. Like, I think for Revolut, you know, the fact that they've gotten this UK banking license is a much bigger deal for them this week than Zippay launching. You know, like, this is something that Nick Staranski, their CEO, has repeatedly said is his priority. It's been a huge talking point in the UK as a political talking point. Like, Revolut is a champion brand for the UK, and like, the fact that it's taken them so long to get this banking license has been a controversial issue for a good few years now. Like, I think, to be fair to regulators in the UK, like, they have 70 million customers worldwide. They're this huge sprawling operation with, like, you know, so many different tendrils that I think in the long run, the fact that it's taken them so long, it shows that their regulatory credentials, or it suggests that their regulatory credentials are sort of, if not ironclad, then sort of credible.
Or at least resilient.
Resilient.
They're willing to be there and keep at it for the 4 years. And Donal, they were only founded in 2015.
That's the thing, yeah, that's the thing. And like, I think I was at a Revolut event late last year, and they were saying we're adding a million customers every 17 days. Like, the pace of their growth is staggering. And the US stuff is another angle. Like, the scale of Revolut's ambitions is far bigger than and that's fair enough. Like, what we're than the pillar banks in Ireland, and so it should be. Like, they're a global brand. It's hard to see.
It will be interesting to see the success of Zippay, and again, whether it is another tail that wags the dog, or whether it is the start of applying maybe a more fintech approach within a traditional banking system that has massive distribution, and to go back to your earlier point, significant profitability as well. Donal McNamee, journalist with the Business Post, thank you very much for joining us here at Taking Stock.
Thanks a million. Cheers for having me.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, we ask, has the Chinese economy grown or shrunk, as it seems to depend on who you ask? Welcome back to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. Now for our trivia this week. When was the first Patrick's Day parade in the world? Where was the first Patrick's Day parade in Ireland? And where was the shortest Patrick's Day parade in the 20th century? Have a think and I'll tell you at the end of the show. Now, I want to look east to China. Economically, it seems to be in a very odd but interesting space. In January and February, its export value in US dollars surged by 21.8%. But in an address last week, we learned that the economy would only grow by between 4 and 5% this year, the lowest estimate in over 30 years. So what's going on? I'm delighted to be joined by Leo Austin, who has worked in China extensively. And Leo, I'm going to start off by putting the context here that the Chinese economy, consumption only makes up 53% of it. Can you give us an insight into how the economy works in China in the most broadest sense of the word?
Well, there's a very traditional economic model, and it's a command economy. It was born out of the Soviet model. So initially, prior to the 1980s, we had a model where the government distributed all capital and it managed all things. But from the 1980s onwards, as they began to understand how to run companies, they changed to a system where really the government allocates credit and it allocates bank loans and subsidies to big state-owned enterprises all over the country, and then they buy from the private sector. And there was a period of time where the private sector thrived, but now it's going more and more government on the sort of state side. So really, the economy in the sort of 2010 to 2020 space was a mix of private and state, but realistically, a quarter to a third of the entire, you know, of all GDP growth came from property and traditional industries like infrastructure. And what's happened over the last 5 years is those traditional industries have declined very aggressively. It's not a small decline, it's a massive decline. And the government has done its utmost to build up a whole set of new industries in higher technology spaces, particularly things like electric vehicles, renewable energy, etc. And they've tried to push exports very hard across the board, but they haven't actually managed to make up the difference at all. And sort of one very simple comment that might be of interest. There is a US geopolitical analytical group called Rhodium Group. They rebuilt the Chinese statistics over the last few years to try and get what they thought was a neutral and fair view of growth. And rather than the government targets of about 5% growth, which we've seen over the last 3 years, they thought that real growth in China was 1.5% in 23, about 2.5 in 24, and about 2.5 last year. So what we're really seeing is, you know, the new economy in China is just not able to take up the slack.
Leo, if I take all of that into consideration, it is rhyming very much with something that was said about the Chinese economy recently, which is that it suffers from low consumption, overcapacity, and the after effects of a collapse in the property market. You can also set it in contrast with the US economy, where one might argue that a lot of the growth that's happening in the US economy is driven by tech and AI. China is backing both horses by both green energy, like you're saying, renewables and so on, as well as technology. If you were to be advising Xi Jinping, what would you be suggesting the economy needs in order to drive on?
Well, let's first understand why the Chinese government hasn't taken the consumption route that it really needs to take. And it relates back to control in the economy. The Chinese Communist Party, above all else, needs to maintain complete control over society. That's, you know, in its kind of big rules. And what it has tried to do is allocate capital over the past decade to things that it felt was important. And the way that it allocated capital was really to encourage very high saving and to minimize, to some extent, the income of rural residents who were controlled by a household registration system and who weren't really able to trade their wealth, their labor for the highest, you know, rates of return. So you saw a lot of money going to the big companies. You saw a lot of money going to the government. Now, if it massively increases income to the rural residents, then it begins to lose a little bit of control over how the economy works. And I think they're working through an internal decision-making process where they very, very slowly get to realize that just has to happen. You know, where we are in China, if you look at China's consumption growth versus its GDP growth over time, it's been clear that compared to Taiwan or compared to Korea or Japan, at the same stage of development, consumption is low. But it's really because rural residents' consumption is low. But what they really need to do above all else is increase the income and the certainty of rural residents. There are 700 million peasants who will really spend if they have some money in hand. And then secondarily, they need to increase broad confidence across the country, which means realistically raising the price of housing or Alternatively, you know, giving people a real sign that the private sector is coming back again. And those are all three things I don't want to do right.
If we go back to the very first thing you said in that answer, you said that the government was looking at spending on things that they felt were important. What you didn't say was spending on things that they felt would lead to sustainable consumption. And I think that's what we're looking at now. But if I look at one of the pieces of advice that you gave is to give more people money in rural environments so they will spend it. And yet the minimum state pension is due to only rise by about 21, which is only about £2 a week.
Correct. There is a big debate as to how they can increase rural wealth, rural livelihood, rural incomes, but they're not there. The Chinese government is allergic to handing out cash, first off. They don't believe, they believe that anything that harks to the growth of a social support system will take a life of its own over the medium term. But, you know, people do see that the rural residents are owed a return. And there's a lot of discussion in society that these are the people who built the big cities. They traveled for 20 years to a big city. They lived, you know, in things which weren't much more than tents, frankly. And they were provided the labor to produce all of these world-class skyscrapers. And a lot of people across China feel they're owed something in return. That conversation will probably take a couple of more years, frankly, before it becomes within the Communist Party, before it has a weight which allows them to change from the traditional model, which is investment-driven, to a new model which says, okay, we don't have to be nice to people in the cities, but at least let's be nice to the people in the rural areas.
Well, Leo, it's interesting you say that it's not there yet, because the big read in the Financial Times this week was highlighting how China claims that it has eradicated poverty. And here is a quote from that piece. Extreme poverty has been eradicated, claiming a complete victory and predicting that the miracle would go down in history. That piece was quite cynical of that approach and saying that simply moving people from rural communities into more urban ones doesn't mean that they have gotten out of poverty. And also, the evaluation of what the poverty line when the goal was set in the first place isn't comparable to that of today. What's your assessment of that?
Honestly, everything I've seen over the past 30 years of working in China has told me they have been astonishingly successful in lifting people out of extreme poverty. Now there's a discussion to be had on what poverty means, but in terms of extreme poverty, you know, you go to rural areas. I've been to two-thirds of the county towns in China over the last 30 years. I've got to tell you, you know, people have places to live. They have heating. They often have vehicles. They might be motorbikes or electric bikes rather than cars, but they have them. But the basic tools of life are there. And so I do believe they've been astonishingly successful in lifting people out of poverty. But there is an issue, which is that that was built realistically on two things. It was built, number one, on people moving to the big cities to work, but was on property and infrastructure, which no longer exists as a sector to keep them. And it was built on rising prices of agricultural products, which the government is scared of because it doesn't like inflation. So the traditional model for those rural areas doesn't work anymore. Yes, they've been successful, but now what next is a big national question.
I think that's the central question, because as I have been looking at the Chinese economy, when you look at the development of it over the past 40 years, it sounds like what has got them here won't get them there. But one of the key characteristics of most recent times is the extreme, and I know we're using that word again, extreme focus on exports. And the trade surplus in 2025 was $1.2 trillion. Certainly there was a sense that if there was going to be significant tariffs, that was going to hurt them. And of course, we've seen how that has played out. But secondly, the question was, if the US was not going to buy as many Chinese goods, was there going to be an export dump, to take a quite crass term, around the world? How has China managed its export relationships globally, not just with Washington?
So I think we have to split this into a sort of a business and economic question, and then secondarily an international trade relations question. And the second one is harder because we're in process. The first issue is, yes, export growth has been absolutely central to the survival of the Chinese economy in the last 2 to 3 years. If we take the Rhodium Group's analysis that real GDP growth last year was 3%, then equally, we believe that export growth contributed half of that, about 1.5% of GDP. So without that, we would have been in a much, much tougher place. So it is very important. And there's no question, about 2 years ago, suddenly it became a big national meme in politics that everyone had to go out. Every single industry in the country was told to go leave China and develop markets outside China. And they all went and did that, and they put a lot of effort in. The US has declined over the last year quite aggressively. Europe has grown. Sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia has grown a lot. And now Southeast Asia, a lot of that's probably going back to the US. Sub-Saharan Africa and Europe, they're growing in a big way. Now, exports itself are not necessarily a problem. I mean, a lot of the imports into China historically were of materials which were then processed. So you can't say that import and exports are important strategically until you understand what they are. What matters in China is that China has been an investment-driven economy, which means they put in tons of excess capacity, particularly over the last 5 years. The less demand they have, the more they've been building factories. That excess capacity creates incredible price deflation. Actually, I talked to a lot of multinationals towards the end of last year in China in one of my roles. And in general, people felt that the decline in sales for those people still left in business had stopped and was steady, and they were feeling positive. But the pressure on pricing was endless. And they felt they had to get even more scale just to drive costs down and survive in the long-term China pricing environment. Now, the issue around international trade is that China has to export its capacity, and it has to export that low pricing in almost every industry that it's involved in. So as Europeans, we have to look at that and say, what is going to be the impact of historically low prices on our commodities and on our manufactured goods? It could put a lot of our companies out of business.
There's something implicit in what you're saying that I want to bring to the surface. When you talk about aggressive pricing, I think something we underestimate about the Chinese economy is the sheer amount of competition that goes on between companies domestically in China. Where you look at the focus on innovation, the sheer amount of choice for an evolving middle class, they're very good at that. They're very good at competing where small things matter. And also in making things that other people around the world simply don't, because China has either priced them out or innovated them out of. What other things do you think we underestimate about the Chinese economy?
I think in general, number one, people who don't go there don't realize that it's much, you know, closer to Manhattan today in the big cities, let's say in the top cities, about 30 of them, it's much closer to Manhattan than it is to what people have in mind of China 30 years ago. The second thing, as you mentioned, is the astonishing willingness to work and innovate amongst young Chinese people. They will walk into industry and they will create a conglomerate in 2 to 3 years. It's as if every young person, you know, only wants to be Elon Musk and nothing else. And that's not reflected where we are today. And the second part is that, you know, the third part of that is that people don't actually understand that the Chinese government decides which industries are going to get the capital, the subsidies, the trade support, the political support. So when China makes a list of industries in which it's interested in, every single young person in China says, okay, I need to be in that industry. And they create a company in that industry. They go to the local government and they'll say, look, I'm in this industry. Please include me in any subsidies you have and any bank loans you have. They go off and they have a big dinner and they get included. So if you have interest in new electric vehicles, you know, 120 new car producers turn up within 3 years, and they're still there today in China. Very few of them are profitable, but they're competing hard against each other. I talked last week to one of the largest car manufacturers in South China, to a quite senior manager there, and he told me they still weren't profitable in new electric vehicles, although they're a very, very big player, because the tail end of the industry would make that impossible. Those would have to die off. So I think that people have to understand that the Chinese will be respected in terms of their innovation. They really can innovate, and they're full of energy. That you have to look at the areas the Chinese government is focusing on, because they're the ones where it's going to build capacity. And that's not just going to hurt other Chinese companies. It's going to hurt us too.
Yeah, but also when you think about the fact that they can absorb being unprofitable because of that centrally planned economy, that changes the game. The last thing I want to mention to you about, if somebody hasn't been to China, I've been to Hong Kong a few times, but I was in Shanghai once. And I remember I was in the back of a taxi and I couldn't communicate with the driver because I obviously didn't speak Mandarin. I couldn't use Facebook. I couldn't use WhatsApp. I couldn't use Google Maps. So I didn't see where I was going. I couldn't see where I was going. And the only thing that worked was WeChat. And I just remember thinking about, in that moment, how much being in the Western world, we can underestimate the self-sufficiency of the Chinese economic model, whether it comes to e-commerce, whether it comes to m-commerce, whether it comes to their own digital tools, their own communication systems. They don't need the Western influence that we think other parts of the world do. And I don't think I could have got that apart from being there.
Yes, it is very interesting. I remember Bill Clinton about, what was it, 25 years ago, declaring that the internet would undermine authoritarian regimes around the world. And in China's case, that absolutely has not happened. What they did at a very early stage is they just banned all foreign internet players from having any access to the market. And then slowly they used security laws to ensure that all data was in China and couldn't be exported. And then they had themselves pretty much cut off from the world.
It's intriguing, Leo, to talk to you and to get a sense just of the sheer enormity, but the complexity of the Chinese economy. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here at Taking Stock. That's Leo Austin, who has worked in China extensively.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask, does the world really need 6G? Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, 6G is expected to arrive around 2030, and it could bring dramatically faster speeds, seamless connection between satellites and smartphones, and even AI built directly into mobile networks. But after all the hype that surrounded 5G, the big question is, what is 6G? How is it different to 5G? And whether 6G really will transform our digital lives? So we're joined now by Elaine Burke, who is the host of For Tech's Sake podcast. And first of all, Elaine, can you help us understand what is 6G? And actually, what does the G stand for in the first place?
It stands for generation. So it's literally the sixth generation standard for mobile networking communications technologies.
Thank you for giving me the definition here before we get started. So what will this mean to you or to me, assuming everything moves in a straight line and it's rolled out in 2030?
Yeah, so what we're thinking of here, so like first generation of mobile communications technology wasn't even called 1G because it just was what it was, you know, and that enabled us to contact people over voice. And then we had the second generation.
You mean a typical phone call?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so those mobile communication technologies where you could call people. Then we were able to text people, which was sending data over these lines. That was 2G. And then 3G gave us way more data they were able to do. And it's every 10 years we get a new standard. And when I say it's a standard, that just means that it's a guidance essentially of like what we're all agreeing as the makers of this infrastructure, that the protocols will be, that the tech specifications will be, so that we can interoperate. So that when we very luckily in the EU have roaming everywhere that we go, but that even though I'm with a certain network here in Ireland, I go somewhere else and I can still use my mobile phone anywhere that I go. And it's so that these networks can all communicate with each other. That's why they need this consistency across standards. And then like with 5G, we had essentially what was supposed to be the explosion of the Internet of Things. 5G was really about enabling more than just phones to connect to cellular networks.
So I have a smartwatch here that is counting my steps, and my steps as they're being counted are being communicated to my phone. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and smaller sensoring devices that also are smart, as they call it, and connected to the internet. And then we also have, you know, the idea of connected vehicles. So like autonomous driving comes with this idea of like a network that actually facilitates connected cars and connected vehicles. So the development of 5G actually also came along with an update to another protocol, the Internet Protocol, which meant that more addresses were available. You know, you have an IP address, mm-hmm. so that everyone has like a unique IP address for their device and location and where they connect to the network. We were running out of IP addresses to hand out with IPv4, version 4, and we needed version 6 because that gave us 340 undecillion addresses.
Like how many zeros?
38 zeros.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was what we got with 5G, was opening up this capacity for a world of connected devices. And like I said, came hand in hand with that development for IPv6. So 6G seems to be mostly about, as the things you said, connectivity that doesn't drop, you know?
Like ever.
Hopefully that's what we'll get out of it. So what we have now to try and fill gaps in networking technology is people building satellite networking technology to assist with that. So Starlink is probably the most famous version of this. And they're even trying to address, say, I think it's the Black Valley in Kerry, which is one of the famous black spots here in Ireland, to try and make it so that they can connect, because they can't seem to be able to be reached by the regular cellular networks. But the problem is, if you think of a satellite connection as like your Wi-Fi, if I'm connected to the Wi-Fi here in this building, but I leave this building, my connection is gone because I'm no longer within range of that Wi-Fi. Whereas on my cellular network, I hop from base station to base station as I move around the world and I don't lose connectivity. So 6G is looking at trying to enable the connection to pass between cellular networks and satellite networks seamlessly, the same way we have that cellular connection that follows us around, so you never get a black spot, you never have a deadline.
Right, so what I'm hearing from you is, number one, faster speeds. The second thing I'm hearing is no latency, which means that calls don't drop or connections don't drop. And number three, more consistency in the quality of the connection. Okay, and all of that sounds good. Now, living in Dublin, one could say one experiences that a lot of the time. Now, where I'm from, certainly I remember, you know, when we were all online in 2020, I do remember having to switch off the camera if I was on a Zoom call when I was at home in part of rural Ireland where I'm from, in Cork, and the difference there between the two. So I suppose that's also a comparison between. But the other thing that I also want to ask you about is, in my research for our conversation today, I came across a term that I hadn't come across before called physical AI.
Mm.
And this is where AI models gain a better understanding of what's going on in the real world. What is that, Elaine?
So essentially, when we are communicating wirelessly the way we are with these signals going through the air, it's on a spectrum of radio waves. And the radio wave spectrum doesn't just have to be used to send information and for us to communicate. It can also be used as a sensing technology. And what they're talking about building in to 6G as a standard is this idea of integrated sensing and communication, so that the base stations, the network, isn't just about enabling communication anymore. It's about being a sensing technology. And if you think about the possibilities there, something that's been quite interesting, and I'd say in the current context, even more interesting than ever would have been before, is the idea that if you have every cell tower enabled to sense things, well, then that might enable better drone detection.
So what would it be sensing?
In terms of defences.
When you say sense things, like what are things? What things are you talking about?
Drones, like, and the thing that's difficult with drone detection is that the low level that they fly at apparently causes challenges, whereas cell tower stations might be able to sense them better if they were equipped to do so. And there's a lot being made of that, because essentially, like, the thing about 6G is, as a standard, it will be set out by a UN agency essentially to make it so that operators will be able to communicate with one another and we'll have that interoperability. But it is, you know, the operators themselves that have to roll it out and build the infrastructure. So to convince them that this is a play worth moving towards, that 6G is worth them investing in, there's opportunity for them to build this as kind of a military and defence technology.
Oh, okay.
And they will get probably very lucrative government contracts out of that.
If I could make it something more tangible and accessible and less controversial, actually, as well, is that when I am driving the car now, with CarPlay, I can connect to Google Maps and it will tell me how long it will take me to get from A to B. And it will suggest that, let's say, there might be an accident or something like that. And then I get a pop-up on the car that will say, is that accident still there or is that something still there? And then I confirm or deny and then I'm feeding into it. Would that be less manual in this case of physical AI? Is it where the 6G would sense what's going on? It would sense the other cars around me and it would much more accurately predict how long it takes me to get from A to B and what's stopping or starting me along the way.
Yeah, so you can have this vision, you know, and I have to say it as a vision because, like, these technologies are still
quite far
away.
Yeah, they don't exist yet. Exactly. We're only talking about what's possible.
Mm-hmm. But you can have this vision of connected cars that are connected to a network that doesn't, and that signal never drops no matter where they go, and also base stations around your road infrastructure having the ability to sense things and feed that information into that network, and the cars themselves sharing that information, you know, an internet of cars sharing information. So mm-hmm. you're not just knowing what your car can sense around its environment, but you're knowing what the car 10 cars in front of you has sensed ahead of you.
Is this really the basis of a big shift into the autonomous or self-driving car? Is this really the technology that needs to be, not just where a Tesla is designing its own car-to-car fleet, but where this would be across the board possible then?
If you want this to be really, really safe, this is probably the way that you want to go with it as well. Because the thing about autonomous vehicles is there's a huge amount of danger in the adoption period where you'll have the mix of unpredictable human drivers and programmed autonomous drivers, which a lot of people think, like, oh, yeah, if you eliminate the human, you eliminate a lot of the risk. But that's not what we will be talking about in the interim period. You'll have a mix of all of those things. And they bring so many variables into the equations that you're trying to program autonomous vehicles for. So the more censoring, the more information sharing, the theory is that it would make things a lot more safer. And it's actually like something that is being researched right here in Ireland. The Connect Research Centre for Future Networking Technologies, they're looking into all sorts of things around 6G and communications technologies. And I've spoken to one of their researchers about how this can enable a smart car network, essentially, mm-hmm. where they talk to each other as well.
Elaine, we've become quite familiar now with how AI works when it comes to, let's say, I prompt an AI tool like Perplexity or Gemini or ChatGPT, and it gives me back an answer. And we understand now how AI works. But if AI is in the network as well as on my device, because that's another possible factor within 6G, what difference would that make to anybody who's listening to us today?
Yeah, so this is another one of the big taglines being used around 6G, is that it's going to be AI native.
AI native, that's
yeah,
right. Yes.
That's what they're calling it. And I suppose what they're talking about is expanding the infrastructure for AI processing and conducting more of that processing at the edge. Now, edge computing is not a new concept to anyone in these kind of industries, but essentially it means that you do processing away from your data center. Essentially, you don't have to send everything down the line to the data center to process and then come back to you. We already do edge processing on our devices when we have enough capacity and information that we need to do it there. But say if you wanted real-time automatic translation of every single world language available to you, you probably don't have the space in your phone to have all of that processing capacity. And you can currently communicate with a data center and probably with a generative AI tool to do that now. But we do see with, say, connected devices that do that, say, like the smart glasses or AirPods and things like that, there is a bit of that latency and lag because your device communicates with your phone communicates with the network sends it down the line to the data center for processing, and then it has to come all the way back down that line to give you the response. So more processing at the edge, if there is, say, some AI processing technology like GPUs built into the network, it doesn't have to go all the way down that chain.
GPU, is that general processing unit?
The graphics processing
graphics,
unit, yeah.
Yes. So I was nearly there.
They were typically made for gaming, and that's why the graphics thing in it, because gaming requires very fast processing and gamers will notice latency to the millisecond. You know, they don't want any kind of latency. So they're actually a really good kind of use case for testing stuff like this when it comes to latency, but real-time translation, like, you do notice if there's a lag with something like that as well. But yeah, gamers will definitely benefit from this edge processing too.
And naturally, Elaine, as I'm listening to you, all of this sounds much more convenient for the average person. However, there's two words starting with E in my mind. One is efficiency, and the other one, of course, is environmental footprint, because this sounds like if it's doing an awful lot more things, even if we can't see them, it's going to take more power. So I'm questioning, how efficient is this process likely to be? And then is there going to be another wave of conversation around, we already have it around data centers, what is going to be the impact of this? And are we looking for incremental increases in our convenience in exchange for a massive impact in the environment?
Yeah, so like one of the aims of the standard, which again hasn't been defined yet, is that it will make things more energy efficient. So it is meant to be a next level up in terms of energy efficiency as well. And that might be enabled by things like edge processing, not having to send things all the way down the line and back again. But also when you're talking about, say, trying to connect your cellular network to satellites, like that can involve construction of great big antennae, because that's currently what you would need to do something like that. So they're trying to think of even the materials involved and the construction involved and trying to make that hopefully as minimal as possible. But again, we don't know exactly how that's going to take shape. So yeah, you're absolutely going to have those impacts. And then you have to wonder as well, why, you know, do we need to do all of this? Like, if we got to this point of being able to process at the edge and we got that to maybe two more generations down the line, you know, another 20 years away. Maybe,
so 7 or 8G.
Yeah. What if that meant maybe we didn't need big data centers and their kind of footprint stuff like that? Like, if you were moving towards that, I think then we would be moving in a very positive direction. But I don't know if that is necessarily where the thinking is going.
I see what you're saying. So rather than look at 6G as an end point, is to see it as a potential stop on a further journey, and could the end not justify the means, but change the trajectory of the means in the first place?
Yeah. And like when the researchers that I speak to in this area, they certainly have those kind of conscientious factors in mind about environment and about sustainability and stuff like that. And the fact that this is always going to be underpinned by research, the phase that it's at the moment is that researchers are doing experiments and publishing work to try and inform these standards and say, this is a really energy efficient way to do this. And this is actually a material that'd be really useful here. And all of that feeds into developing this standard. And that gives me a bit of hope that we'll be going in a good direction with it. But then, yes, absolutely, we do need the telecoms operators to want to build the stuff as well.
And, you know, Elaine, while we're talking about this as being very futuristic, the reality is that Ericsson has been trying this out in Texas in recent weeks. So this is closer than we think. So thank you so much indeed for joining me. Elaine Burke, host of For Tech's Sake podcast, All Around 6G, an area we'll be back talking about again, I'm sure, Elaine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Bill.
Now for our trivia, earlier on I asked you, when was the first Patrick's Day parade in the world? Where was the first Patrick's Day parade in Ireland? And where was the shortest Patrick's Day parade in the 20th century? Well, the world's first St. Patrick's Day parade took place in Boston in 1737. And would you believe, the first one in Ireland didn't happen until 1903. And it took place in Waterford. Now, here's my favourite. The shortest Patrick's Day parade in the 20th century was held in the village that I'm from, namely Dripsy, County Cork. In fact, I was set dancing in it. 3,000 people came to watch us cross the road that day. It will be forever in Dripsy's folklore. And we made it to the Guinness Book of Records as well. Now, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first thing on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks a million for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day and indeed your St. Patrick's Day. I look forward to chatting to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business.
Sunday morning at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.